However, not everyone is happy about this satellite launch. The US expressed anger at Iran's partnership with Russia and accused Iran that the aim of the satellite is spying, something Iran has categorically rejected. The US has said they suspected that the satellite could be used by Moscow to spy on troop movements in Ukraine. Yet, Iran is resolute in its cooperation with Russia. It has said it will continue production of such satellites with Russia, adding that it's a great honor for Iranian technicians to work alongside Russian technicians who have more than six decades of experience in the field.
Yes, well, the US government, of course, is particularly concerned about this. It really, in many respects, it should have seen this coming. It should have seen cooperation between states that it has under attack coming. But the arrogance, I think, of the US in particular, of Washington in particular, blinds it to these sorts of developments. They could ignore the fact, for example, that small states like Syria, like Cuba, were able to cooperate together. But when large states like Iran and Russia cooperate together, there's the inevitability. There's going to be new developments which free those countries, those peoples, from the domination of the US.
The launch of Khayyam satellite has been hailed as, quote, an important milestone in Russian-Iranian bilateral cooperation that paves the way for implementing new joint projects. It has ushered what Iran has dubbed as its strategic aerospace cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Russia now says it's open to cooperation in the field of space exploration with all interested countries and partners, specifically Iran. The launch is also seen as a major achievement for Iran, despite Western sanctions.
Okay, so it's very important. The cooperation between Iran and Russia in satellite technology is very important because it shows a cooperation between large states with great capacity, which are both under economic blockade by Washington in particular. I would say Washington rather than the West, because really there are some mixed feelings in some parts of other Western countries. But certainly Washington is very jealous of any sort of independent achievement by Iran or Russia.
Iran says Western sanctions cannot stop its scientific progress. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said that the successful launch of this satellite is a great achievement for Iran. This comes as Iran has made significant achievements in the field of science and technology in recent years. Earlier this year, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Force launched its second homegrown satellite into a low Earth orbit nearly 2 years after the launch of its first military satellite. The IRGC successfully put Nur 2 or Light 2 into orbit on March the 8th. Iran has already mastered the technology to build remote sensing satellites with an image resolution of 5 to 10 meters and can inject up to 50 kilogram packages into an orbit of 500 kilometers. But Khayyam can hit a much more precise resolution of 1 meter. Iran aims to achieve the technology to put a 100-kilogram satellite into the 500-kilometer orbit by next year.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, braveness of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And in today's lesson, we are talking about the braveness of Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam. No personality was braver. No personality was determined and more valiant than the personality of Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Al-Imam al-Hussein is seen throughout all the stages of the history of humanity because his eminence on the day of Karbala was in such a position that the intellects are perplexed and minds are bewildered at it. All the minds were bewildered. All people were surprised of how this particular eminent, this particular Imam was. Imam Hussein had a very surprising position in the land of Karbala. The generations venerate his memory and regard his bravery with absolute astonishment. Everyone was astonished about his personality at the time. And people have considered his valor higher to that of the well-known valor of his father. He was braver than his father was. He's considered to be braver than his father was, considering and looking at the fight that he took, looking at the stand that he took in the land of Karbala. People could easily consider that he was much braver than his father was at the time, because his father faced so many battles, of course, with braveness and everything, but not a battle resembles the battle of Karbala. So his cowardly enemies were shocked by the strength of his determination and the aim, because the Imam did not stay back. He had that type of valor, the type of braveness that everybody never really understood. Everybody was shocked, including the enemies. They were so much shocked with his braveness. And this is one of the very main important traits that we learn from the life of Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. We're talking about the braveness of Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In today's topic, the braveness of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam really is something for us to reflect. When we look upon the happening of Karbala, the fight of Karbala, we realize that he was such a personality that stood braver every time when he was in front of his enemy. His cowardly enemies were definitely shocked by the strength of this particular personality, his determination, Al-Imam Hussein's determination and aim, because the Imam never stepped back due to the continuous horrible strikes that befell him, one after the other. They were fighting him, sending every type of weapon against him, but he never stood back. And the more the difficulties increased and the calamities intensified, the more steadfast he became and the more his face shone. And, you know, when all his followers and his Ahlul Bayt were martyred, all the armies consisting of 30,000 mercenaries, according to some reports, surrounded the Imam alayhi salam from all sides. But you see, the Imam, though the lone survivor, attacked the hordes with ferocity of a wolf attacking a herd of goats, and the enemies despaired in fear and trepidation, they were fleeing in front of him in all directions, and he was like a firm mountain, and he faced the swords from all sides in such a manner that there was no sort of laxity on his part. He did not care for death with all his bravery. Sayyidi Haider says, when he alone, Al-Imam Hussein, faced a particular group, all groups were terrified before him. His spear was on his fingertips as if they had made their swords for that same purpose. The sword was married to the self, and its door was death, and its henna, the dust and soil of the battlefield. Thank you so much for listening. Till next episode, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I can't hear that.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be left tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence filled the air.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Culture, Politics, all produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Despite international standards and the admonishments of Canadian courts, Canada continues to practice different forms of abuse in its prisons. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Catherine Latimer, Executive Director of John Howard Society of Canada. This article is published under the heading, Why Does Canada Still Allow Torture in Prisons? Here's more. Eddie Nalen bled to death in a segregation cell at Millhaven Penitentiary in 1974. For every year since, prisoners have courageously marked August 10th as Prisoners' Justice Day in Canada. Despite this international standard and the admonishments of Canadian courts, Canada continues to practice this form of abuse. They fast, refuse to work, and think about all prisoners who have died. Long before the medical science backed them up, prisoners knew that being locked alone in a cell indeterminately would undermine sanity and drive them towards suicide. The consciousness of Canadians has caught up with what prisoners have known for years. Prolonged solitary confinement is torture. Canadian appellate courts in BC and Ontario have now held that indeterminate periods of isolated confinement violate charter rights. Class Nation lawsuits have been successful, resulting in damages for the cruelty prisoners experienced for being held in segregated confinement for more than 15 days straight. The United Nations defines solitary confinement as 22 hours or more alone in a cell without meaningful human contact. More than 15 consecutive days of it has been prohibited as cruel and a form of torture. Yes. Despite this international standard and the admonishments of Canadian courts, Canada continues to practice this form of abuse. In 2019, Canada repealed legislation permitting administrative segregation, one form of solitary confinement. Ministers said This would be the end of solitary confinement in Canada. They were wrong. Confinement in cells for more than 22 hours without meaningful human contact continues under different names, from dry celling to lockdowns to medical observation. The list is long. Solitary has worsened over the last 2 years with a ready public health jurisdiction for cruel confinement. Most concerning is that structured intervention units, or SIUs, that were built as the answer to abusive solitary confinement now perpetuate it. Professor Doob and Sprott's analysis of SIUs revealed that 10% of SIU placements result in prohibited, prolonged solitary confinement or torture. This finding was accepted by the Minister of Public Safety before a parliamentary committee. When parliamentarians learn that Canadians are being tortured right here at home, the practice should be stopped immediately. Canadians should not tolerate other Canadians being tortured by state officials. Stopping this is not difficult. Direct and legislate correctional authorities to cap solitary confinement at 15 consecutive days. Ratify the optional protocol against torture and denounce torture in all forms, particularly in own backyard. The correctional investigator, auditor general, senators, and advocates have raised countless failings in correctional system in Canada. They are frustrated that recommended reforms have been ignored. It would take a wholesale transformation of the federal correctional system to fully respect the rule of law and provide prisoners with the rights and justice to which they are entitled. But surely stopping practices that are recognized in international human rights documents by Canadian courts as cruel and torturous is not too much to hope for on this prisoner's justice day. How many more Eddie Nalins will Canada fail?
Start. Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and other life forms. Welcome to yet another episode of Youth Station, brought to you by IRB English Radio. I am Zainab in the studio at the honor of being joined by my brother and co-host.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brother Habib, at your service.
Wa alaikum salam.
Thank you guys for joining us. And today, what are we going to be talking about, sister?
Today, I thought we'd talk about, this is definitely something you can put your 2 cents in because you'd be speaking from personal experience. A lot of people from all over the world, they have this ambition, like this goal of going and living in America. Like it's been...
The American dream.
There we go, the American dream. It's been the goal of some, it's been the goal of people since that nation was like constituted and established. They would migrate from all over Asia, Europe. But not Australia for some reason.
People were actually would go to Australia.
Yeah, exactly, because it was a new land, right?
Yeah.
To go and live in America, and like you said, to chase the American dream.
Usually the people who want to go to America are usually people from the third world countries.
True.
Or who consider themselves from third world countries.
People whom America considers a third world country.
There are also categories of people, classifications of people who want, for example, for media reasons, like they want to become famous people, like John Oliver. And, for example, actors, actresses, you know, America is the capital of media.
Exactly, Hollywood.
Right? Hollywood and stuff like that. And there are people who want to expand their companies.
Mm.
People who want to base their companies in the United States because of the, you know, it being a capital of investment, a capital in...
entrepreneurship.
Exactly.
And it's got a very booming, very thriving economy, right?
Mm.
And the thing about it is I think people believe that anything can happen in America.
They see it as a chance for a better
exactly.
life.
Exactly. A chance for a better life. But you know what's news? Apparently, Forbes.com has reported recently that due to some ongoing factors in America, including inflation and weird gun policies, have been leading Americans to want to leave the States.
It is very weird.
Their gun policies are for real.
Yeah, like mass shootings have become something ordinary in
exactly.
the news.
Exactly. It's like
every day you see someone, like a mass shooting.
Yeah. It's like a Tuesday morning thing.
And now, of course, you know, like I always said, these reasons why people go, cultural reasons, transportation. Some people I know want to go to America for health reasons.
Yeah.
For doctors, the medical opportunities that are available.
Medical care is, their health care is really awful too. That's another.
Yes.
But like, so basically these things, gun policies, racism, politics, capitalism, the fact that their politicians are just getting older and older. All of these reasons have been leading Americans to want to leave the States. And no one talks about that side of the story.
Yes, yes. I always tell people, like, you guys dream of going to the United States. You guys, I'm not sure you guys are going to be able to live there.
It ain't all that.
From the culture point of view, from the, like, alien point of view,
yeah,
where
exactly.
you're like, you're an outsider. And I always tell them about this street, right? There's this
Where did
Anaheim,
you guys live
California,
when you guys, okay.
Right? So in Los Angeles, it's literally just one cross of a street between the best of houses and the homeless people sleeping
exactly.
on the streets.
And that's crazy.
I remember walking with my father, you know, like, it's like because we go to LA because he used to buy clothes, you know, from like the shipment would come to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
He would go over there. And he would put on the car. We would walk a little bit to see what's new in the streets and everything. And I literally remember this. It's like you're seeing the best of buildings, the best architectures.
High-end buildings, real modern.
Exactly. And you're seeing, like it's a city, like a utopia city.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You just cross the street.
Literally,
you're waiting for that red light, right? You're waiting for your turn to cross the street. When you cross the street, all of a sudden it begins. You start to smell that
stench.
That eerie smell.
Yeah.
And you start seeing families living on the streets.
Yeah, I mean.
Families living on the street, eating from whatever is left over from people. And usually
digging through the trash.
Yeah, and of course these homeless people know how to be homeless. Because you have to have a place close to a gym where they could shower, for example. Or close to a restaurant where the leftover foods, they could take it. That's one aspect that people usually forget.
You guys are listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
What people
see, or
what is assumed as the best of countries, there are various lines of poverty, there are various lines of middle class people. And who says that you're going to live as one of the, you know, top-ranked rich people
exactly,
in the United States?
Exactly. I mean, those who do make it in the States, I'm not saying that people don't succeed there, but those who actually do make it are not the majority of people who migrate to the States. They can be really racist, especially when you go to, like, the South, the rednecks. Why?
It's very hard. You know, I remember this. I remember a story from my father. He was with his friend, and they were going to, if I'm not wrong, Nebraska. And it was a restaurant. they were sitting down in the restaurant and they wanted to order their food. Mm. People around them, the waitress herself, told them to get out. Why? Because they're Arab. And my father's friend was, you know, kind of brown-skinned.
Oh.
So it really just gave off.
Like, so, and this was like, what, 15, 20 years ago?
25 years ago.
Ooh, yeah, no. That wasn't a good time to be an Arab in the States.
Yeah, yes. Very dangerous.
Very hard times.
Very dangerous. Of course, Los Angeles, New York, because of the diversity available in California, in New York, for example, in Michigan,
yes,
those are much easier places to live in. You know, in Michigan, you walk in the streets and you see restaurants written in Arabic. You know, it's like you're living in Guzar Khan. Oh, you know Guzar Khan? It's like the Arab, the Arab market.
Yeah.
Like, you know how you guys have Chinatown?
Exactly. Y'all got
Guzar
Arab
Khan
town.
Is Arab town. Michigan, especially Dearborn, is Arab town.
Exactly. On one hand, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, Inna ardullahi wasi'a. Y'all got a problem in this corner of the world, move. You're not a tree. Go to another corner where you can find provisions, where you can provide for your family, where you can safeguard your religion, where you won't be oppressed.
Go to Canada.
Oh my God, yes.
I don't
Canada
know.
Is actually very accepting of immigrants because their labor is really expensive.
I have my cousins.
They're like their local labor force. And also their population is like crazy low.
I have my cousins in Canada. They're actually happy with the country. It's cold.
I like the cold.
Oh, some Arabs don't like the cold. Anyway.
True. But see, and then, so on one hand, there's this, right? Go to other places. Allah says, I created this world hella vast. Y'all can just go and explore. But then on the other hand, I feel like a lot of the persecution that they face, especially when they go to Western countries, they wouldn't face if they would just sit in their countries, in their watan, as they say, right? In their homeland, their birthplace, and try to rebuild it instead of, you know, abandoning ship like that.
Sometimes saying it is very easy and doing it is very hard.
True.
And you have to go out. Of course, when you go out of your country, people usually think about the worldly side too. Moving to a different country, to this country or that country. For example, no one's thinking about going to, this country in the Middle East. I'm not going to run away from my problems in the Middle East to the Middle East.
To another place.
Or to Asia. Okay. I'm actually talking with people these days who are thinking about immigrating. And I always tell them that you're always thinking about the worldly matters. When you go there, you're going to get it. You're going to feel much more relaxed than you are in the current country you're living in. For example, this country doesn't have any electricity, no water, no gas. But at the end of the day, if you go there, there's one thing you have to keep in mind. And that is you and your children. Why?
How are you going to raise them?
How are you going to raise them, one? And two, religion.
Yes, it's such an
not only culture,
factor, though.
Right? Like, leave the Arab culture alone. Leave the, you know, the Middle East culture alone. There's this, you know, religious factor in it. We see it in the second generation of immigrants, the third generation of immigrants. They lose the language.
Yeah.
When they lose the Arabic language, when they lose that language that connects them to the religion, their lifestyle
they can't
changes.
They
can't. Liberal lifestyle comes and changes them.
For sure.
The concept of, you know, being free and, you know, there are a lot of topics
being Western,
that
being totally
might be sensitive
whitewashed.
To talk to people because they might find them harsh. But that's the reality, you know. You're not going to be acceptance of various laws. You're not going to be questioning and doubting various laws. Anyway,
yeah, exactly.
It's a problem, really. Like, you cry for Imam Hussein, right? But what gives you the certainty that your children will cry for Imam Hussein? I'm not saying that everyone that is living in an Islamic country is going to be able to raise their children correctly.
Nor are we saying that everyone who
lives
moves
outside
to the West,
is going to lose their children. But we're saying that it's much harder.
The
much
risks
harder.
Are higher, yeah.
Yeah, the risk is higher. And the environment that you're living in is very dangerous.
Are you glad you moved out of the States?
I am very happy, unlike my sister.
Oh, she hates it.
Yeah, she hates it here. Not here. She hates the fact that she's living in a, you know...
Not in the States.
Not in the
she'd
States.
She'd like to go back.
Yeah. And the reality is that when we came to these Islamic countries, we were like aliens, right? So it took us time to get used to, you know...
And you adapted better, obviously. Way.
And also the Arabs who go, who are religious people, who, you know, become aliens in different countries, also have this, you know, problem.
For sure.
We have to get used to, you know, certain things. I'm not going to go into details because some of them might be very sensitive.
Yeah. Anyway. I actually had a friend who lived in LA as well. And then when he was a kid, him and his brother, it was him and his father came to the decision to move the family to DC because there was like a tighter Muslim community there, and he thought that is necessary for the religious and spiritual upbringing of his kids. And I thought that was like some boss move, you know? Like, more power to you, man, to like be living in the West, the like the most Western West of all Wests, and be living in freaking LA, and then be like, nah, I ain't gonna raise my boys here. I'm gonna go somewhere else that they can find a community. And like, fast forward 25 years, his kids finished their degree and then came and became seminary students and then went back home and got stuff done. You know, that's like, I feel that's literally the definition of best of two worlds.
Yeah.
Right? Because they lived well when they were in Qom as seminary students, which it's so worth it. The fulfillment and the gratification that comes with it. You feel like you conquered some huge dragons. Anyway, we're almost out of time. Just to wrap this up, we want to say that not everything about the States is bad, obviously. Who am I to judge? Not everything about not the States, countries other than the States is bad. We are allowed to travel the world in order to build a better future for ourselves and our future generations. But we need to get this idea out of our head that the States...
The grass is not always greener on the other side.
Beautiful. Thank you, bro. And thank you to our listeners for being with us on this episode of Youth Station. Until another salam and greeting, I leave y'all in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. In weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
In the limelight.
China plans to warmly invite Taiwan back into its arms. The Chinese acted with soft power by increasing trade and tourism between the two countries. A soft power approach amounts to persuading the Taiwanese people that there is no reason to fear reunification with the motherland. We now present you an article written by Mohammad Reza Jofar, an expert in geopolitics. The piece is titled Soft Power, China's Strategy for Taiwan. The geostrategic atmosphere in the South China Sea has been tense following the recent visit to Taiwan by U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. This brought to the fore the issue of China's marine embargo and Beijing's need to access strategic straits in East Asia, which have been traditionally controlled by allies of the U.S., including Japan, the Philippines, and Indonesia. China's eastern and northeastern ports are limited to marine routes that go through the Sea of Japan and the East China Sea. Under south and southeast, Chinese ships have to cross the Malacca and Sunda Straits in the Philippines and Indonesia to access international waters. Therefore, Beijing attaches great importance to facilitating the transit of its ships, and the possible escalation of tension between China and these countries over marine routes has been a subject of discussion by experts in geopolitics over the past two decades. There is an archipelago between China and the Pacific Ocean, which Beijing calls the first island chain that falls within the limits of its territory. China's relations with its neighbors have been damaged over the ownership of more than 200 small coral islands. These sea passages provide access to some of the world's most important shipping routes through the South China Sea. China is trying to gain control of all these passages because it fears that at a time of heightened tensions, it may lose access to them. Japan has been a major impediment to China's free access to the Pacific Ocean. Look at the existing sea routes shows that when Chinese ships leave the Yellow Sea and circle the Korean Peninsula, they have to cross the Sea of Japan and La Perouse Strait before gaining access to the Pacific Ocean. Most of this area falls within the marine territories of Japan or Russia and may be close to China in times of heightened tension. Even if the Chinese cross the strait, they must still go through the Kuril Islands to the northeast of Hokkaido, which are collectively controlled by Russia but claimed by Japan. Although China and Japan have many border disputes, their row over La Perouse Strait is the most important one, which restricts China's shipping in the northern and eastern waters of the country. Taiwan, whose official name is the Republic of China, is also known as the Chinese Taipei, National China, and Formosa. It is a region in East Asia comprised of the islands of Taiwan, Penghu, Kinmen, Matsu, and a number of other small islands. All of them are located off China's eastern coast. Via its sea borders, this island nation neighbors the People's Republic of China on the west, Japan on the northeast, and the Philippines on the south. Taiwan is located below Okinawa, in the South China Sea, and is away from mainland China. Chinese officials consider it as their country's 23rd province. However, it is currently an ally of the United States, and its naval and air forces are equipped with American weaponry. Taiwan went under China's ownership in the 17th century. According to the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979, the United States is committed to defending Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. However, this will not be the case if Taiwan declares its separation from the mainland, as a secessionist policy by Taiwan is considered a major provocation and will be deemed an act of war by China. Both governments strive to gain official recognition for themselves, and it is Beijing that has been mostly successful in this regard. With a population of 1.4 billion against Taiwan's 23 million, China enjoys more power of persuasion and geopolitical clout than Taiwan. The Chinese do not want Taiwan to be able to vie militarily with Beijing. Instead, they have acted with soft power by increasing trade and tourism between the two countries. China plans to warmly invite Taiwan back into its arms, a soft war approach amounts to persuading the Taiwanese people that there is no reason to fear reunification with the motherland. China's general policy is to try to maintain good relations with most of its bordering countries, so as not to allow any separation movement to be organized or supported. What is certain is that China will never let go of Taiwan due to geopolitical reasons, because Taiwan is both a commercial and an energy transit route and a buffer zone for China against the Pacific Ocean. Also, it is not unlikely that China's failure to govern Taiwan will trigger widespread internal unrest that will threaten the Communist Party's influence and China's unity, because if the Chinese government accepts Taiwan's separation from the mainland, it is possible that the suburban and marginal areas would enter into a conflict with the central government in Beijing. This, in turn, would also bring the buffer zones into the conflict. Nevertheless, in a situation where China's military power is on the rise, Taiwan and the United States will show less desire for a military conflict. For Beijing, Taiwan is a small threat that can be managed. Now that China is the second largest economy in the world, it has a global advantage. Beijing has the initiative, and in the event of any sanctions or war, the United States will suffer more than any other country. While the European Union was the main victim of the sanctions regime against Russia, the situation is completely different in the case of China. Moreover, the international community will not be able to take the brunt of sanctions against China. China views Taiwan through a geopolitical security lens, and they would naturally assume that the Westerners are trying to harm China's security. However, China's security will not be compromised. Political geography and realities on the ground are against Taiwan's secessionist policy. It should be noted that China will not show much flexibility in the case of a blockade of the existing sea routes, such as the Sunda Strait, the Taiwan Strait, and the Malacca Strait, through which 80% of China's energy resources pass. In case such policies are implemented, an all-out crisis will occur in the South China Sea. Beijing intends to dissuade its neighbors from getting close to the United States and change the opinion and method of the United States as well. Therefore, it is investing in deep water ports in these regions, an investment that would bring China closer relations, trade connections, and the possibility of friendly bases in other countries for naval deployment. China considers Taiwan as a breakaway province that should be reunited with the mainland under the internationally recognized One China policy. Under that policy, nearly all countries recognize Beijing's sovereignty over the island, including the United States of America, which has no formal diplomatic ties with the territory. However, in violation of its own stated policy and in an attempt to irritate Beijing, Washington continues to court the secessionist government in Taipei, supporting its anti-China stance and supplying it with massive caches of armaments. In flaming tensions between the United States and China, the 82-year-old Nancy Pelosi stepped in Taiwan on 2nd of August, prompting Beijing to react to the highest-level U.S. visit to Taiwan in 25 years, with a burst of military activity in the island's surrounding waters. Recently, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said at a press conference in Beijing that China would resolutely fight back against every U.S. provocative act that undermines its sovereignty and territorial integrity and meddles with its domestic affairs. Warning of the escalation in tensions, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said, "Pelosi's trip to Taiwan is a major political provocation to upgrade U.S.-Taiwan exchanges." Wenbin added, "It violates the commitment to maintaining only unofficial exchanges with Taiwan made by the United States in the communique on the establishment of diplomatic relations between China and the United States, violates the One China principle widely recognized by the international community and confirmed by the United Nations General Assembly's Resolution 2758, and violates the norms of international law of non-interference in internal affairs established by the United Nations Charter. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said Beijing had warned Washington well in advance against Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, and that such a trip would cause a crisis and major disruption to China-US exchanges and cooperation. The spokesman said the US side is going further down the path of hollowing out and distorting the One China principle, but it accuses China of changing the status quo. The United States conducts up to 100 military exercises in China's surrounding waters every year, but accuses China of overreacting. China will not accept this thuggish logic, nor will the international community. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman, Wang Wenbin, also noted that every time the American side makes a serious provocative act of infringing on China's sovereignty and interfering in China's internal affairs, the Chinese side will resolutely fight back. China will never allow its sovereignty and territorial integrity to be wantonly trampled upon and sabotaged.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on July 27, 2022. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remnant of God on the earth. I welcome you, gentlemen, my dear brothers, from across the country who are working in highly sensitive, important organization. I'm glad and thankful to God, and after several years, 2-3 years, I'm able to meet you in person. I take it as a good omen that this meeting is taking place during the days that belongs to the household of the Prophet ﷺ, from Eid al-Ghadir to the day of Mubahila. The revelation of Surah Al-Insan and the verse of Wilaya, guardianship, and the blessings that exist in these days of this week. I hope, God willing, the Lord will guide us in the way of the Prophet and his household, peace be upon them all. And God willing, we will be able to move in their path.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The day of Mubahala is a very important day. The day of Mubahala is the day of prophethood and the day of wilaya. The event of Mubahala is both proof of prophethood and proof of wilaya and imamate. For this reason, this day is very important. I hope that the Almighty God will keep us steadfast on this blessed path. I'd also like to thank Mr. Haj Ali Akbari, both for his efforts and for the things he spoke about here. The issues that were mentioned were correct and good. I have prepared some items which I have written down to share with you, my dear brothers. One point is about the position that the Friday prayers hold, and we, as Friday prayer leaders, should realize the importance of this. When a person becomes aware of the importance of a job or a responsibility, he gives it priority over other tasks and pays more attention to all related aspects of it. We need to know this, and so do other people. The IRIB and our officials need to inform people that Friday prayer is not merely a congregational prayer in a mosque. Rather, it is a great and important phenomenon in a city.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Austria is famous for its stunning architecture and artistic legacy, boasting to be the home of the great German composers, including Mozart and Beethoven. Sadly, however, Austria has built up another reputation in recent years, that of growing intolerance towards its Muslim minority. According to data released in June 2022, over 1,000 Islamophobic incidents were reported the previous year, a shocking increase which has grown year upon year. Research into anti-Muslim hate crimes in Austria have found that the overwhelming majority of the incidents which take place has been men targeting women, with a staggering 69% of victims being female, many of whom wear the hijab. However, it's not just on the street level where the targeted harassment of Muslims is taking place. The sharp spike of 2021 was allegedly assisted by the controversial state-implemented Islam map, introduced by authorities to highlight the location of all mosques across Austria. Critics believe it aided in the spread of hate crimes. Press TV sat down with Iman Shaker, who's experienced firsthand what it's like to be a target of hate after she was almost physically assaulted for wearing a hijab.
I don't think you can name a single visibly Muslim person in this country that hasn't been verbally attacked or even physically. And I try to not give a lot of attention to the individual attacks I face, because that would just be, that would just be very...
Although it was hard to relive the experience, Iman doesn't believe in playing the victim, instead focusing on the root cause.
Focusing on a single perpetrator and focusing my anger towards him would be very weakening, in my opinion, because in the end he has fallen victim to the narrative that the state has given him about us being a threat.
In November 2020, Austrian authorities launched Operation Luxor, which saw homes and offices of Muslim charities and activists raided as part of a so-called war on political Islam. But critics claim its only achievement is dehumanizing Muslims and fueling growing public fear towards Islam. An increase in fear almost certainly leads to more hate. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the U.S. forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence, which refers to the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in the defense of South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine activists marched through central Vienna on Friday to vent their anger following Israel's recent bombardment of Gaza. They joined thousands of other protesters worldwide who were shocked into action after the three-day Israeli offensive left over 350 Palestinians wounded, 46 dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials.
Following the recent violence against Gaza, shocking images of children suffering and dying went absolutely viral on social media. Yet despite these disturbing images doing the rounds, they haven't been routinely featured in Western mainstream media circles. In fact, it's incredibly rare for any images of Palestinian suffering to be published at all.
They are suffering every day, every single day. People got arrested, children got arrested, people got murdered. Gaza, what we saw last week in three, 4 days, got bombed. They have no electricity. They have no way to go anywhere. They are blocked from the Israeli occupation.
I need to tell my people that we are standing up for them. We are resisting from abroad. So you have to stay strong. And I'm an artist, so it is a duty for me to raise the voice for the ones who are not heard.
We need to raise our voice, and Austria cooperates with Israel, and that's what we are doing here also, is that we want to make people aware of this, that Austria is cooperating with Israel.
Despite regular condemnation of Israel